Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Ribinus. A quick thank you to everyone who's left a rating or review on iTunes for me, including in the last week. I jumped up from 875 to 938 at last glance, which is stupendous. If anyone out there who loves the show hasn't yet had a chance to leave a rating or review, please help me get to my goal of 1,000 ratings on iTunes. Appreciate it tremendously. Now let's get to the program. I'm excited to have with me today Rachel McCarthy James, co-author along with her father Bill James of the book The Man from the Train, the solving of a century-old serial killer mystery. In it, she and her father not only set out to solve the notorious Velasca Axe murders, but also a series of other killings across the country. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me about this.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric.
So for those listening who don't know who your co-author Bill James is, would you mind giving us a little biography, both of him and of you as well?
Of course. So my co-author, my dad, Bill James, if you know him, it is probably from Moneyball. He's a baseball author who also works for the Red Sox, but he's famous for his baseball obsession, but he's always been equally obsessed with crime. And in the last decade or so, he's been writing a lot more about that. His first book was Popular Crime, and that came out in, I think, 2009, and this is his second crime book. We both live in Lawrence, Kansas. I went to Holland University in Roanoke, Virginia, and I've written for Bitch Magazine, McSweeney's, and Hazlitt, among others. In my day job, I work in administrative support for climate scientists.
This book is filled with a really disturbing series of murders spanning decades. What was the research and writing process like for you for this book? What did you do? What did your dad do? How did you and your dad split your time?
Of course. Research is my favorite part of the writing process, and so I love talking about it as well. It's really always fascinates me to see how people track down their ideas and try and find out more about them. So we mostly work separately, and then we would meet for breakfast to discuss the case. I actually am not a breakfast eater. I just like coffee, but my dad loves breakfast. So we would go to one of a few places, usually the Big Biscuit, and we would compare notes, talk about our theories, overarching theories. Other than that, we mostly would send emails. both of us kind of like to have our own processes. So when he hired me, it was with the idea that I would go off and follow my own instincts, do my own things, and figure out what it was that I wanted to find from this case, not just following his directions. So what I would basically do is I would find a case, and I went about that a couple of different ways. At first, I just went backwards, trying to find more crimes of the description that he initially gave me. And after I found enough, I realized that I needed to do it a little bit more methodically. So I started in January 1890 and tried to find every single family murder I could in the United States between 1890 and 1920. I went month by month searching the term family murder as well as a few other terms, trying to find stories of these cases and then writing them down in a spreadsheet, keeping track of them and sending on the ones that looked likely to Dad, whether they were because they were unsolved or with an axe or whatever. And he would judge the cases and then ask me a few more questions about them usually, discuss them with me, whether or not he thought it was likely. Sometimes he would think something was really likely at first, and then later on the process, he thought, nah, not so much. And then he convinced me with the Stetka murders in Canada, especially. But usually what would happen is I would find the case, I would write it up in a kind of narrative and give him the newspapers that were relevant to it, and he would work it into a longer chapter. So it's about 80% his voice, and then I come in a little bit here and there, but it's hopefully not too jarring for the reader. I tried to mimic his voice as much as possible, so hopefully I'm the only one who can recognize little paragraphs that that came from the emails I initially wrote to him.
I do want to ask you about the unique voice that is used in this book.
Yeah.
Because it's different than other styles in this genre.
Yeah, it is.
You speak directly to the reader at various points. Why did you choose to do it this way?
That is Dad's voice, which is very distinctive. You know, a couple of times I've gotten some pushback about it, and, you know, it's not my voice exactly. It's very much my dad's, and sometimes me trying to imitate it pretty well, I think. And, you know, some people have pushed back because it's very folksy. It's very conversational. Sometimes a little bit too conversational, some people think. And sometimes I think that too. But, you know, Dad really has his own voice. That's one thing I really admire about his writing, is that it's very distinctively him. And I think in a lot of people who have gone through MFAs and done a ton of workshops and really polished their voice into something shiny, you know, that's really great to read, and I enjoy reading that. But Dad really has his own voice, and that's one thing that I really enjoy about his writing, is that it's very distinctively him.
Absolutely. So with so many gruesome murders to cover, and there really are a lot in this book.
Yeah.
It must have been emotionally draining at the end of a day of research.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, there is an acclimation process. And once you get to know the cases and get past the details and start looking for them in other things, if you're expecting to find them there, it lessens the, I think, emotional turmoil that comes up with it when you initially start researching it, because it is hard. It's, you know, it's a lot of awful details to process and think about and try and weave into a narrative. But it's not easy to stomach. And you know what? That's why I mostly worked in the mornings. After a few months of working on it, At first I was doing my usual thing of working at all hours of the day. But that became problematic after a while. So I started just working in the mornings, because it is harder to get depressed in the mornings because you have a lot of light and sunshine and it's, you know, plenty of time left in the day, harder to get down on yourself. So I would do that in the morning, and then in the afternoon I would work at an after school program down the street at my old elementary school. And that was much more active and fun than sitting in a chair looking at 1,000 old newspapers a day looking for the same details. And then I would give myself a break from the case at night and just do something else. So I was pretty careful about managing it. I took care of myself for sure while I was working on this.
Did you ever have bad dreams?
I have bad dreams anyway. I never really had any specific serial killer dreams though. That's never been something that super scares me because I don't know, especially with this book, if this guy broke into your house, you were dead. And it was kind of like, well, if I am going to go out by a serial killer, they're probably pretty determined and I don't have a lot of say in that. So I'm just going to write off that whole possibility and make that deal with myself because it's not that common. And, you know, there's no reason to think about fixate on it. It's just one of those things you have to manage, I guess.
Well, you don't live on an isolated farm, at least.
No, but I do live extremely close to the train tracks, like very closer than any book in this house. And I moved there. I moved into this house right as I was starting work on this case. So it was very crispy at first working on this book about that was so specifically tied to looking for train tracks and then hearing the train go by three times a day as it does.
Yeah. So jumping right into your book here, we obviously can't go over all of the murders, the massacres in your book. We'd be here for hours and hours. There are a few, though, that I would like to ask you about in more detail, and I'd like to start with the Velaska Axe murders in southwestern Iowa. As you spend a lot of time covering this case, and it's also one of the most notorious in American history. So neighbors made a grisly discovery at the Moore House on the morning of June 10th, 1912. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. So J.D. Moore was a really popular guy around town. He was the owner of a local John Deere dealership. He had very friendly, sometimes a little too friendly, but he was a guy who didn't have a lot of enemies. He and his wife, Sarah, had four children of their own. And on the night before June 9th, 1912, the whole family had been at a Children's Day service at church. They had a 9-year-old daughter named Catherine who asked her friends, Lena and Ina Stillinger, to join them that night for a sleepover, which sounded fun, I'm sure, to both of them. That night, the constable saw a man walking through the park towards the Moore House and thought to shine his light on his face, but did not end up doing so. The next morning, they did not come out and perform their chores. I'm going to read if that's okay.
Yes, sure.
About 7 a.m. Monday morning, a neighbor noticed that no one was stirring outside the Moore House. The Moores had two horses, two cows, and some chickens, all of which needed attention. But the chickens had been squawking in their coop. The Stillinger girls had not called home after daybreak, as they had been told to do. The neighbor knocked on the door, but the door was locked and there was no answer. She let the chickens out of their coop and called Joe Moore's brother, Ross Moore. Ross Moore checked on the livestock and then circled in the house, banging on windows, trying to see in the windows and yelling out to see if anyone would answer. The neighbor returned. Ross unlocked the front door and or forced it open. The house inside was very neat and entirely clean, but tainted with a foul odor and a terrible stillness. Across the parlor, there was a small bedroom called the parlor bedroom where Catherine Moore normally slept, although on this night she was upstairs with her brothers. Ross Moore opened the door to the parlor bedroom, saw blood everywhere, and the bodies of the two young girls, obviously bludgeoned to death. He staggered back across the porch, and moments later, sitting on the steps of the front porch, would utter these exact words that appear in countless crime books. Something terrible has happened. So this was completely out of the blue, but it, because of the horribleness of this crime, it embroiled this community in a debate that is still raging to this day, basically. There's still debate over whether it was our man, the man from the train, or whether it was Frank Jones, or another creepy minister named George Kelly. In every major crime case that becomes kind of an event, there's always going to be someone who gloms onto the case, becomes too creepily obsessed with it, and eventually inserts themselves into it. And in this case, it's the Reverend George Kelly, who was this kind of itinerant weirdo who confessed to the case and whose trial afterwards became a big moment for the town. So in most of these cases, I did the bulk of research, which was mostly tracking down as many old newspaper reports about it as I possibly could. But with the later cases, and with especially Valeska, the research has already been done in large part, and what wasn't done before I came on the case was basically performed by my dad. He really was the one who got to know the Valeska case, especially in really great detail. Because there's so much written about it. It's been written subject of a number of books. There's a really good documentary about it. And I would say we're not even the main experts on Valeska. I would say that's Dr. Edgar Epperly, who's been fascinated with the case for decades and decades. But there's a reason that became so fascinated by it. And that's because so many weird characters come into it that are woven from forgotten parts of American culture, I think. So Kelly was essentially traveling across churches in the Midwest, taking seminary classes and kind of hobbling together a preaching career. And he was at the Children's Day services, and after that was sleeping a block away at the house of a minister, and he became obsessed with it after the fact. The way, you know, you see a lot of people still to this day who have this over fascination with specific crimes. And sometimes it can lead into a place where you get too involved into it and it kind of sucks you in. And that's what happened with him. Eventually, he began to not be able to distinguish his fantasies of the case from the reality of it, and had a bit of a mental break, and afterwards was put on trial and was eventually exonerated. I mean, even back then, a lot of their knowledge, they weren't watching lawyer television shows, so they didn't know a lot of these tricks and trades that sometimes I'm sure people who go through the process now would know, but they still knew a false confession when they heard one and saw a man in the grips of mental illness when they saw one. So I think that's what happened with him. I don't consider the case against him to be super credible.
He called himself a reverend, but I can't remember whether he was actually a real reverend or not.
No, he wasn't. He was never, no, he was not.
You said he was working at the church. Did he give lessons to the Moors?
I don't think so. No, I'm not super familiar with the details of Reverend Kelly especially, but I think he was just hanging around, like, trying to getting in good with the preacher and taking classes. And Dad describes him as an intern in here, and I think that's pretty accurate.
The other question I have about this case relates to Frank Jones. He was a suspect that a lot of people are still convinced was the real murderer.
A lot of people still think that Frank Jones did it. I met with some relatives of Sarah Moore last spring, and they expressed the view they still believe that Frank Jones did it. And I understand that, because it's really hard to comprehend the scale of this crime. And when something like that happens, you don't look for the almost supernatural sounding logic of a serial killer did it, of somebody came in and just randomly killed people just for his own reasons. You look at revenge, you look at personal grudges, you look for motive, basically. And I think that's why so many people have focused on Frank Jones. And I understand that. I understand how, you know, people become invested in an idea and don't want to be proven wrong. Certainly, I will go through that, I'm sure, at some point with this book. Somebody will want to prove me wrong, and I won't want to be proven wrong with one case or another. But I just don't see the Frank Jones explanation as credible. I mean, the scale of this case is beyond what I could imagine. Someone who is functioning normally in society and has no other tendencies towards violence, as Frank Jones did not, you know, I can understand if it were just J.D. Moore who was murdered, that Frank Jones did it out of a want for revenge, out of the business rivalry, out of whatever. But to kill six children is another matter altogether. It's hard for me to believe that you could even pay someone to do that in that time period. You didn't have, you know, wannabe assassins quite the same way you do that. You know, there were no soldier fortune ads and people who dark web ability to hire horrible, horrible criminals. So I just don't think that Frank Jones would have done it himself. I don't think that Frank Jones would have hired anybody to do it based on his rivalry with J.D. Moore. I just don't think he would have killed those kids. Yeah, and especially in such a horrible, desecrating way.
And that's generally considered to be the motive, this rivalry between them. Moore first worked for Jones in his hardware store and eventually began his own, siphoning off business from Jones.
Yeah, and I think there was a rumor about maybe Moore was getting up to something with Jones's wife, you know, which are all, you know, reasons for Jones to hate Moore, but I just can't see. I mean, and that's just looking at it individually. That's without taking into consideration all the ways in which this very well-detailed crime fits up with a lot of other detailed descriptions of crimes across the country. So, yeah, obviously I have a vested interest, but I do not think that Frank Jones did it.
I mean, it makes no sense on the surface.
I mean, I don't want to, but at the same time, I don't want to, there are people who are probably still, there are people who are still, whose families felt the impact of it through the generations. And I don't want to say it's silly to have believed that. I understand how that fits into the logic a little bit more than some horrible man riding the rails. But I just don't think it was. But Frank Jones had relatives, too, and he's got descendants, too. And I don't think he did it. You know, his store is still there. I saw it. I went to Valeska this summer, and his store is still standing. It still says the Jones store, big, tall, white letters on a blue background.
Yeah, I guess what I don't understand is that if you hate someone so much, I mean, killing that person, of course, is terrible and extreme and wrong, but it's still different than massacring an entire family over, what, business? A possible affair? I mean, how does someone get to something that's just so gruesome and horrible as massacring an entire family?
Absolutely, absolutely. And to do it silently without anybody noticing till the next day, that's cold-blooded stuff there. And that's what we were, part of what we were, you know, when we were researching these cases, that's part of what we were looking for, is this kind of horrible professionalism, the way he was able to dispatch these families fairly quickly and silently, and obviously extremely brutally and bloodily.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. You point out in your book the stark differences in how the Valeska murders were treated by the press from the Paola Axe murders, which happened really close by and just days apart. The Valeska Axe murders are internationally known. The town of Valeska's tourism industry centers around them. But it's interesting that other slayings happen not that far away, but they're treated far differently both then and now.
Well, first of all, Paola's not very far away from where I live. I've been there multiple times. It's about 4 hours away from Valeska by car. So it's not super, super close, but it is a pretty quick trip on a train, more so than a lot of the separations in a lot of these cases. But I think Valeska is really an outlier in a lot of ways. And the way in which it is most an outlier is that it was so well remembered and well recorded and debated for so long after it happened. You know, we've got dozens of cases in this book, and none of them have, that are all just about as horrible as the murder of the Moore and Sillingers. But none of them have had this kind of long lasting legend attached to them. It's really exceptional. So it's kind of hard to compare, say, why not Paola? Well, why not the Brookfield murders, the San Antonio murders, or the Colorado Springs murders? Why were they not as well remembered as Valeska? Valeska is really the outlier here. But with Paola, I think part of it, you know, there's a lot of different, local journalism was really inconsistent back then. Not all cases were reported equally. Some of them are just third-hand newspaper reports to the point that we are not confident about the names of the victims. You know, spelling was less standardized back then, yes, and that's an issue we face with every one of these cases. But in one family, we don't know if their name was Kelly or Kathy or Smith. With the Akermans, we don't know the names of the first names of most of the family members. Both those are out of Florida, which does not have a lot of surviving local journalism that we had access to. Sometimes, like I said, it's lack of surviving local journalism. Sometimes it's classism or racism. Sometimes it's questions of reaction of the community. With Paola versus Valeska, I think it's partially about scale. In Paola, two people died. It was a young couple, Roland and Anna Hudson. And in Valeska, there were six children brutally murdered, devastating multiple families. That's just going to cause more of an outrage and spur on more coverage than the murder of two other people, two young people without children would.
Yes, that makes sense. So back then, locals were consumed with, in not only the Valeska murders, but in the others that you write about, they were consumed with finding a member of the community responsible for the crime. I guess it's easier to blame someone locally, especially when the demand for justice in the community is so strong. But there was a concern amongst some reporters and others that the killers responsible for their own town's tragedy might have been connected to other ones across the country.
Yeah, they didn't have a framework for serial killers, so it took them a long time to catch on. But in 1912 especially, he was increasing his pace. 1911 and 1912, he was killing a lot more frequently than he was earlier in the decade. And also the speed of technology was increasing as well. Newspapers were more interconnected. There were more wire services, et cetera. So there was an awareness that there was someone, they called him Billy the Axeman, traversing the country.
So you set out in your book to prove that a single serial killer was responsible for dozens and dozens of murders across America. But first, of course, you had to find the commonalities among them all to link them to him. What were these similarities across all of these cases in general that led you to believe that you were dealing with one individual?
Well, a lot of the groundwork had been laid before I got onto the case. I already had a pretty well-described framework to work with it. I already had several examples. You know, there is a great Smithsonian piece that lays out all the similarities between Valeska and the other cases, Paola, Colorado Springs, Washington, et cetera. And also I want a paper by a woman named Beth Klingensmith, who wrote a paper for her Master's of Library Science degree for Wichita State University, an online course she was taking. She wrote this incredible paper that really lays out a lot of similarities, and it had a second life online and took off from there, and that became a foundational document for us. But what we were looking for, so I already knew what to look for, and it was basically this. A family is murdered in their beds within a short distance of the railroad track, near the hour of midnight, with the blunt side of the axe, without any warning, in or near a small town with not much of a police presence, without a robbery or any clear motive, and without any obvious suspect afterwards. So those were the things that I was basically looking for. But we, you know, there's a lot of different cases in here, and some of them we don't have. We have more detail and we can see the commonalities between those cases as well. He would often remove the lamp, the chimney of the lamp that he was using. He would lock up the doors. He would cover the bodies with cloth. And so when we saw one of those, we had a much clearer case for it being connected. But we talk about a lot of cases that we're not quite as sure about in here. And because we did not see, you know, I looked at a lot of different murders from this time period, And there was a difference between one where three members of a family were killed by an uncle, the motive was an inheritance, or it was a servant who was doing it out of revenge or something like that. When we saw one that was without a whole family, especially, and without any motive or apparent warning, that's what really made us take notice, as well as the phrase, the most horrible crime that has ever been committed in this area. That was a big watchword for us.
So you look for crimes that didn't have obvious motives. But there must have been a motive in all of these murders for the man on the train. What do you think his motive might have been in doing what he did?
I mean, some people are just what his motive was. He wanted to kill. I just think that it was a compulsion for him. I think it's something that he enjoyed and got a sick fulfillment out of. And, you know, it's hard if you're not the murdering type. It's hard to, I think, understand that allure, but that's something that we should be glad for. It's something that I can't understand to be sure.
And there was a sexual component to all of this as well, right?
Yeah, there was a sexual component. There was evidence of masturbation at a lot of these, the scenes of these crimes. So that was an element as well, that it was how he sated his lust.
We will be right back.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
And we have returned. Again, we can't go into every single family massacre you believe might be connected to your killer, but based on your profile of him, what examples would you give of murders that you are absolutely convinced were done by this man?
The ones that we are, I would say very sure of, 90% or more sure of, the Newtons in 1898, the first one, the Lyerleys, the Hughes, those were the families in South Carolina and I believe Georgia, in which people were lynched there shortly after. The Meadows and the Hoods, who were in southwestern Virginia and West Virginia. The Schultzes and the Castaways, who were both in Texas. The Hills, the Burnhams, the Waynes, Dawsons, Showmans, Hudsons, and finally the Moores. So those are the ones that we're very sure of. And that's a 59 people total. And then there's some that we're a little less sure of. Some of the ones that I just listed, Dad's more sure of than I am. But those are the ones that we're overall very confident about. Then there's ones that we're slightly less sure about. The Allens, the Kellys, McCaffeys that I mentioned earlier in Florida, as well as the Ackermans. And that's largely because we just don't have enough detail about the crime. In some cases, we've got less than 100 words. So those are the ones where we feel that it fits his pattern and where he was in that frame of his life, but we're not quite positive about it because we don't have the same details of the crime scene or other surviving details. And then there are some where it basically looks like him, but there are other people who are suspected or there are certain details that are off, wrong time of day, for example, or being a little too far from the train. And so there's a lot of different, it's in total, we estimate it at, our best estimate is 101 victims.
Do you think that any of them might have been copycats?
I think that's a possibility, especially with the black family murders in the 1910s and 1911s. There's definitely more than one person who is killing families there, but it's similar enough that you have to wonder if, for example, some racists decide to see that this campaign is going on against black families and decide that they want to take that opportunity to get away with some horrible crimes. And it could just be somebody else that was operating during that time period. It's hard to say. So I don't think copycat murders is something that we can't rule out. But with some of them, it would be hard for him to copycat the exact details because they're so spaced out over the course of 14 years or so.
And you mentioned the time of day. You write in your book that he typically committed his murders just before or just after midnight.
Around midnight, yes. Definitely after dark, but well before dawn. So between midnight and 2, usually, sometimes a little bit earlier, sometimes a little bit later. Definitely not in the daytime. If we saw a crime that was in the daytime, that was one thing that would just immediately rule it out. I wouldn't even bother sending it on to Dad.
And this killer that you've identified doesn't have anything to do with the Axeman of New Orleans, right?
No, we don't think that he was the Axeman of New Orleans. The Axeman of New Orleans, he did not kill people like he had the benefit of 14 years of practice killing people. He was very messy. He was very random in how he would strike. So I'm not an expert on the accent of New Orleans, but I trust Dad with that when he said definitely not him.
So I'd like to, if you don't mind, get more specific on a handful of these cases. One that's especially intriguing is the double event that happened in Colorado Springs.
Sure. So the double event happened on September 17th or 18th, 1911 in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I have been to the site of these crimes. Both of the houses still stand, actually. They are maybe 50 yards from each other, and currently no more than 100 yards from a rail trail bicycle track, which was, of course, at the time, a railroad track. Very small little houses. If the address is in here, and I went and visited it before the publication of this book, and immediately someone saw me on the street looking around at these houses and said, "Oh, you're here for the murder houses. Yeah, there's been a bunch of ghost shows here," and showed me exactly where it was. They're still standing. There's a couple of dog out. There's a dog outside in one of them, and toys in the front yard, and who knows if it's even changed that much since 1911. So in this incident in September 1911, it was the Burnhams and the Waynes. And in both cases, there's the same details we have everywhere. Blunt side of an axe, killed in their sleep, door locked afterwards. And a double event is fairly common is not uncommon for serial killers. The most famous example being Jack the Ripper, who committed a double events in London's West End on September 30th, 1888.
And another quick word from our sponsor. And again, back to the show. At one point, you write that if you are ever 100% certain that two of the murder events in your book were done by the same killer, they would be the ones in Villasca, Iowa, and the ones in San Antonio, Texas, right?
I would say the ones that I always come back to as the best examples of a man from the train crime are the murder of the Newtons in Brookfield, Massachusetts in 1898, the murder of the Castaways in San Antonio in 1911, and then, of course, the Valeska murders. So those are the ones where we have a high level of detail about the scene of the crime, and for whatever reason have just really stuck with me. With the Castaways in San Antonio, Louis Castaway was a really intriguing figure. He was, you know, in most of these cases, I would try and research the family members and try and find something, and usually I wouldn't come up with too much. But with Louis Castaway, there's a ton of detail about his life. In the years before his death, we have records of him getting a promotion from janitor to porter at City Hall on the front page of the San Antonio Light. There's details about his 36th birthday party. It talks about him raising money for a gymnasium. In 1898 as well, he was involved in a dispute in the local Republican party in San Antonio. The Black caucus within the party walked out over a disagreement, and then later both sides came together to record a statement of resolution and unity, and Louis Castaway was listed as being part of the person behind that, one of the people behind that. We know a lot about his family. He was married to a white woman named Elizabeth Castaway, born Elizabeth Castelow. And she was very young at the time, and their elopement caused quite a stir, but they were able to live peacefully and carve out a nice life for themselves. They had three kids. He was the janitor at the local school, and that one sticks with me. But the details in those crimes, I mean, we've got a lot of his signature elements, the door being locked up, the lamp being left off the chimney, being left off the lamp, moving of dead bodies afterwards, killing with the blood side of the axe. It's just a lot of his everything we look for in the crimes that he committed.
So you laid out an approximate timeline for the man on the train. There are some gaps, some years where no murders are committed. Do you have an explanation for that?
No, we don't. We looked for him in prison records, but he was probably using a different name than the one that we know at that point. So no, we don't have any explanation for that. It's possible that some crimes were committed during that time and we just missed it. He might have been in jail or prison. He might have been on work assignment somewhere else. We just don't know what was happening in 1907 and 1908.
I'd love it if you could talk about the moment when you realized that you had a real suspect. How did you find Paul Mueller?
The night before, I had been working on the case for a couple of months at that point, and Dad had told me that at some point I would go back far enough that I would find the first murder. The night before I found the Newton crime, I emailed Dad and asked exactly what he meant by that, and he said, something will be different about the crime. There will be something that basically exposes his inexperience at that point. So the night that I found him, I just moved back to Kansas. There was a train going by all night that I wasn't used to at all. And my husband left me alone so we could go to a concert. And I was looking at another murder that did not end up in the pages of this book. It was in Maine. And there was a lot of back and forth about where this guy was, and I was trying to track him down. And one of the related cases, related stories about it, I think it was in the North Adams transcript, it said at the very end of this, the person who did this, I'm paraphrasing, the person who did this is surely the same fiend behind the murder of the Newton family in North Brookfield 2 years ago. I had found this Google book, which was the history of the police department from 1600 to 1904. And in it was a description of the Newton family murder in North Brookfield, Massachusetts, January 1898. And I was reading through it, and it had all the details that at that point I had known to look for. The doors were locked up, back of the axe was used, whole family with no known enemies, most horrible crime ever committed, etc. And at the end of that, it said the person responsible is surely Francis Newton's handyman, Paul Mueller, who was last seen headed for the train. And at that point, I knew that I had something. I tried to get my dad on the phone. My dad does not pick up the phone, but I tried to call him several times anyway. He was in Boston at the time, so he didn't return my calls. So I wrote him a bunch of emails. The first one I remember was I used a ton of qualifiers to describe what I was found. I might possibly, maybe, could have found a potential culprit for these crimes. And so I laid out my case, and he wasn't convinced right away. He wrote back that I'm going to have to look at this further, and we can't be sure that this is what it is. But this is certainly an intriguing narrative. To have somebody whose name is actually attached was a big thing in the case because we really didn't have a name prior to that.
Did you have a backup plan? What if you hadn't found a suspect? Do you think you would have still written the book?
I have no idea. That's a good question. I think probably we would have because we didn't really... Dad was not really super expecting me to find the actual first crime. He was expecting me to find more crimes with the description so that he could, I think he probably would have written a book about it. I don't know. It might have just ended up being an article on his website or something like that. I do think he would have written about it. I don't think I would have been a co-author if I hadn't found Paul Mueller. The book still might have come to pass. It might not have. It's kind of hard to say. You know, being a writer, you start on a lot of projects and you put a lot of work into them and then not all of them actually pan out. But I think Dad probably would have done something with this.
There are no known illustrations or photographs of him, but there are some physical descriptions, right?
Yes, he was a short man with widely spaced teeth, had an angry expression all of the time. And I think there are some descriptions of scars on his face and hands as well.
In the case of the Brookfield murders, the Newton family massacre, it was assumed that he was simply a disgruntled worker, right? Angry about something.
Yeah, that's what it, I mean, that's, I think, what it would have had to have been. Francis Newton was not known to be a super warm and friendly guy. Several people said that he was in the habit of speaking sharply to his employees. So it's certainly possible that there was a personal grudge, but I don't think you can blame Newton for that. He didn't know that he was lodging a murderer.
It's interesting because you have enough there. There are enough eyewitness accounts that place him at the train station.
Yeah.
Details about his demeanor. I mean, it really brings the story to life. I mean, it gives a face to the evil.
It's really vivid to see. It was really shocking to see, kind of see the forerunners of what he would do later, him refining his technique and getting better at getting away with it. You know, in the first case, as with many cases, he attacked someone who to whom he was personally known. After that, left that off. But the fact that so many people saw him walking to the train station, being at the train station, saw him putting on a hat and then taking it off to distract him later. And the police really chased down a lot of weird leads. They were really focused on whether or not he got lunch at a specific counter somewhere not long after it. And it, you know, at that point, he was already long gone. And, you know, it's funny because we talk a lot about the inadequate police departments in these cases and how they were completely unprepared to deal with a monster of this capacity for violence. But the train companies actually had train detectives who would have been much better at tracking him down based on a physical description. Of course, in his later crimes, they didn't have a physical description, but if they'd worked with the trained detectives on that first one, who knows, maybe they would have been able to catch him.
As far as the murders of the Newtons, were there any differences between these murders and the ones that came later?
Yeah, there was a significant difference. So in the first 10 years he was killing people, he would usually set fire to the houses afterwards. He would do this to probably burn up the evidence, probably distract people while he was getting away as well. In Brookfield, he tried to do this. He soaked a pile of wood with gasoline and threw a lamp at it, but the lamp failed to catch fire. So not only did the house not catch on fire, the entire scene was preserved, which allowed us to link him to later cases in a way that we couldn't with some of these other ones where he successfully set the building on fire afterwards.
So in your book, you theorize that he may have gone to Germany at some point and committed a very famous crime there.
So Paul Mueller was a German sailor. That's one of the things we know about him fairly for sure, if we know anything. You know, we know he was short. We know he worked for the Newtons. We know that he was a surly guy based on the early reports. Not much was known of him personally, except that he was a German sailor or claimed to be. So in the 1920s, there was a murder of a family at a farmhouse in Hinterkaifeck, about 70 miles north of Munich. We're not experts on this case, but the broad outlines are a lot like the Valeska and Newton and other murders that we think were committed by the man from the train. So that's not one of the ones that we're super sure about, but we think it is one clue as to what he may have done afterwards.
Has anyone approached you about turning this into a movie or a television series?
Yes, we are developing one right now. I can't say too much about it right now, but we're developing a television series. We recently did some work on that, and we're really looking forward to seeing if we can get it made.
It's got to be a little tricky. shows like this typically have some sort of heroic figure, some investigator that tracks the bad guy.
Well, I mean, there's a big appetite for true crime these days. And, you know, I think people are fascinated just by the cases within themselves. And, you know, there's not one hero in this, but there's a lot of little heroes of this. There's a lot of people who were leading lives that deserve to be remembered for something more than their death. So I think there's a lot we can dig in on narratively there if we get the chance to explore this on the small screen.
Interesting. I guess there are a lot of ways that this could be produced for television.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm a writer. I'm not a producer or anything. So they'll have a lot of ways about how. It's a very difficult story to tell. It was one that we puzzled over quite a bit when we were trying to write the book as to how to approach it and make it digestible and not horrifying, not just endless misery. So I hope that so I'm looking forward to that process for sure.
Have you traveled to any of these communities? I know you already mentioned going to Colorado Springs. Have you been to Villasca as well?
Yes, I've been to Villasca once. I spoke to a conference of judges there. They had me to speak, and I had a lot of very good, productive conversations with them. I talked to Dr. Epperle, which was a great, great chance to get that opportunity. And it's been a warm reception. I think that they really see the merit of what we're saying here. They also see its limitations, but that's not a bad thing. So I think the reception has been pretty good. I did go to Colorado because Beth Klingensmith, who I mentioned earlier, actually lives there, but only one person came to my reading, so I didn't really get a good sense of the community. I had a conversation with the descendants of Sarah Moore, not descendants, the relatives of Sarah Moore. And that was, you know, we had a good conversation, a productive conversation. I don't know if they've entirely bought into what I have to say, but of course that's their prerogative. One thing that was surprising to me is a young man I knew from high school, a basketball star from high school, believed he may be related to one of the men who was lynched in North Carolina for these crimes, which is a very sobering connection to find, but certainly a reminder of how many lives this affected and how many communities it affected over all of America.
I can totally understand how difficult it must have been to organize your book. As someone who reads a lot of true crime books for this show, there is a pretty obvious pattern for most. First a crime, then an investigation, and finally a trial. There's a fairly predictable arc. So while reading this, I understood how incredibly vast and complex your subject is. The fact that you were able to organize it into something cohesive and readable, I mean, with a climax at the end, kudos to you for that.
That's all credit to Dad. That was entirely Dad's invention, his organization. That was entirely his idea. And it's so difficult to arrange in a readable way. And I really think he did a great job with that.
Have you gathered any new evidence since the book came out?
I haven't focused on it a ton since we turned it in and began the process of editing, 2 or 3 years now. The thing about this book is that there's so many murders that it becomes hard to keep track of them, especially when you're not actively in the process of researching them and finding out more about them and working on what you've already written about them. Some people have come to us with some interesting evidence, but so far, nothing that has really changed the narrative arc so far that I've seen. I think my dad has talked to somebody who has found the immigration records for Paul Mueller. So that's one thing that I'm really excited to see. But I expect we'll be looking at some new evidence once if this television show sells. And I think that we'll be looking at the evidence with a fresh eye and probably gathering new evidence and new resources for that project. I did one thing I did find, actually, I completely forgot this. One thing I did find is I was answering questions for something a while ago, and I happened to Google the Newton crimes, and I found somebody who found pictures of the Newton family and posted them on his little local history website, completely unaware that this had any connection to it until after the Manson screen came out. So that was one thing that was neat to find thereafter, was these pictures of these people who we hadn't seen before. In a lot of these cases, you know, we know what the Moors and the Stillingers looked like, but with a lot of these other cases, we didn't have any photographs of them or any other sketches of them. So that was one thing that was exciting to see.
This seems to be a book that would be ripe for a second edition a few years down the road.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, maybe. I'm hoping my next book will be my own project. But yeah, I would like to see another edition. I'd really like to see another edition with more maps and charts, because I think that was something that was missing from the editions that are out right now. Yeah, I would really like to go into it and do a second edition, but it'll be a lot of work. So we'll have to see about that.
Sure, sure. Is your next book something true crime related?
Yes, it is true crime related. It's a little bit broader than The Man from the Train, but it is true crime related. But I'll hopefully have something to announce there soon.
So your dad has kind of sucked you into the genre, huh?
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, I've got there's a lot of different interesting ways to go with it. Yeah. So it's a really rich field. Lots of intersections with history, and so I'm excited to keep working there.
So your books are pretty much available anywhere books are sold.
If you want to order a signed copy, you can get one from the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas, and they sell copies online.
And for anyone who wants to contact you directly with questions or additional information, is there a way that they can do that?
Yes, I think the easiest way, I really need to get a website together, the easiest way to get in touch with me right now is probably just to look at my Twitter page. Just Google Rachel McCarthy James Twitter, and my email is in my header there. So you can contact me through Twitter or just send me an email there. My email is rmccarthyjames@gmail.com. So anybody who'd like to get in touch, please do.
Well, thanks again. This has been so interesting.
Thanks so much, Eric. I really appreciate your having me on.
This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.